Hello and welcome to Talking Property with CBRE. I'm Catherine House, your podcast host, and in this latest episode, I'll be talking to the CEO of a highly successful online travel group about how he's rewriting the experience of booking a holiday through a big new bet on luxury bricks and mortar stores.
Certainly for Chatty, we didn't expect it to be as successful as it is. We thought, oh, I think we can cover our costs, maybe make a little bit of money and get that brand carry. But it turns out it's actually quite a profitable store and probably, I suspect, the highest grossing travel store globally.
That's Adam Schwab, co-founder and CEO of Luxury Escapes, one of the world's fastest growing travel brands with an annual turnover of around $1.4 billion and circa 600 staff on five continents. While the group is known for being a digital brand, Luxury Escapes recently opened its second Australian store, complete with free-flowing champagne, and has a global store network on its business plan. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Adam, welcome to Talking Property.
Great to be on.
So you certainly have an entrepreneurial background. I read that you started out as a corporate lawyer and then launched your own business at just 25 with a mate you'd had a side hustle with at school selling assignment notes to other students. I'd love to hear how that morphed into what's now Luxury Escapes.
We had a series of pivots. So our first pivot was leaving our corporate jobs, me as a lawyer, Jess as a banker, and started that backpacker apartments business you talked about, then pivoted to a corporate apartments business, and then pivoted to our first online business, which was actually it was a restaurant booking business that kind of converted to a takeaway ordering business. I'm going through a few different businesses here. That became part of Menulog, which recently unfortunately shut down. But we fortunately had sold the business and had a great result there. This was about 10 years ago. At the same time, we started effectively a discount experiences business called deals.com.au.
Yes.
Started that business, and that was essentially the forerunner to Luxury Escape. So we had sort of really four or five pivots before we started this business. And even once we started Luxury Escape, as I'm sure you've spoken to lots of business owners, you sort of change, you're changing the business constantly. We've had sort of pivots within the business as well. So it's there's never a dull moment.
No, it doesn't sound like it. And you were recently awarded the top travel retailer at the Power Retail All-Star Bash, and that recognises excellence in Australia's e-commerce industry. So why the move into bricks and mortar?
We look at inspiration was probably Apple. In a similar, like obviously Apple's one of the most valuable businesses in the world, so we certainly don't compare ourselves to them in terms of scale, but they were essentially a business that sold through channels or offline. And I think one of the great pivots that Steve Jobs did and that Tim Cook sort of expanded was their retail stores. And Scott Galloway, who's a great podcaster, calls it one of the greatest value unlocks ever, possibly the greatest value unlock ever. And if you look at our product, and what Apple really did was demystify the product, took it in, allowed it to be much more accessible. And you walk past an Apple store, there's hundreds of people in there getting help, getting advice. And we thought travel's really similar. It's a business that's heavily trust dependent and it's complex. There's millions and millions of different options you can do, if not billions of different options and combinations of options and flights and land and tours and cruises and all the different stuff you can buy. And we just thought, well, why don't we give it a crack? But there's really two benefits. One is you get the sort of trust marketing carry. And even if the store itself doesn't make money, it's a really great sort of homage to the brand. So we sort of thought, well, hopefully we can break even on the store. Obviously, our fit-outs are expensive and our rent's in pretty prime spots. So we wanted to make sure we gave it a real crack. So we knew that would have a pretty significant cost. We thought, well, even if we can't make money, that's still a great way to sort of get the brand in front of people and really build that trust with our customers and with our potential customers. As it turns out, certainly our first store, Chadston's, been incredibly profitable and Bondi's heading that way as well, obviously a much newer store. So they've been really successful on a financial basis, but plus we've got this incredible brand carry on top of that.
So talk us through what the stores look like for listeners who might not have been into one or walked past one.
Yeah, the aim was really how do we make the Apple store of travel? And travel stores, I won't sort of mention specific competitors or if you even call them competitors, but other travel stores are very homogenous. They're generally three or four desks and it's probably 150 square meter space, generally not particularly light, not expensive for that. Now, they're very functional and they serve a purpose. And if you want to, and you go in there and sit across a desk and it's not a bad experience by any stretch. And so I don't want to criticize them because a lot of our contemporaries are incredible businesses, but we thought we could create something a bit more special. And if you look at what Luxuryscapes does as a business generally, is we want to create the world's best holidays. And that's not just from the moment you step on the plane, that's from the moment you start planning and booking. And we wanted to create that really amazing booking experience. So you walk into a Luxuryscapes travel store and there's lots of green everywhere, there's calming colours, there's lots of wood, it's a really expensive fit out. It's a sort of 300 to 400 square metre space, so probably double to triple the size of even a decent sized travel store. We can have up to sort of 15 consultants on the floor at one time. And the way we've designed it is if a consultant's not busy, they can just jump on the phone and answer. We've got an almost infinite number of phone calls coming in. So we knew we could overstaff the stores and allow that sort of pivoting between roles for our team, which other companies don't quite have the luxury of. So we knew we could make a bigger store than potentially we needed. We also run wholesale, weddings, corporate, all that kind of stuff from the store as well. So, but if you go to the store, it really looks much more like a sort of a general luxury, sort of almost luxury handbag store or luxury clothing store than it does a travel store. And both our Bondi and our Chatty stores have a really great size bar, so you can get champagne, you can get barista made coffee, and you get warm chocolate chip cookies in there. So, and obviously that we don't charge for that. We just give that to our customers as part of the buying experience or the travel booking experience or the planning experience even. So we want to be able to have a really nice sort of third space that people can come to. And even if you're not going to buy from us, even if you want to just sort of work out what a trip may be, you can buy from booking.com or wherever. But people tend to buy from us because our consultants are amongst the best in the world and they're running this really nice environment to buy in.
So the store design seemed to have really been quite the differentiator. I was reading a recent article about Luxuryscapes and it had some interesting quotes from Danny Latouf, who's with retail consultancy, The General Store. And he said, if you're selling dreams, your store should feel like one, that the physical space should transport you before the plane ticket does. He also said, you know, travel is one of your top three biggest life purchases, but when you walk into most agencies, it feels like booking a dentist appointment. Luxuryscapes certainly doesn't look like a dentist office. And I've also heard that you're getting a much higher spend per customer than you do online. Can you talk us through those numbers?
I think Danny makes some really good points there. So, yeah, we really did sort of go over the top with the in-store experience, and that was intentional. So you spend a bit more on the fit-out. I suspect Apple spends $10 million on fit-out, so we're nothing like that. But we'd be significantly more than the average travel store fit-out. And we have an amazing designer in Katie Damon at George Berry who does an amazing job, and we sort of put her through the ringer a bit and constantly change the designs. We've got amazing building partners at Trust. So we've got a really good team now that's put together now a bit of a blueprint for when we roll out further stores across Australia. But yeah, it's we really did try and create a certain look and feel to really give our customers that holiday vibe as soon as they walk in. And it doesn't come easily. There's a lot of work that went into it and a lot of sort of thought and thinking and evolving and adjusting that goes into it. And our Sydney store, I think, is even improving. Our Melbourne store is amazing. Our Sydney store, probably helped by having a lot of natural light, is I think even better. And I think our next door, whether it's sort of Queensland or WA or SA, where we're sort of fine-tuning where we go next, I think we'll be even a step up again. So we're just taking the learnings from each store and trying to build it better and better each time.
Because I read that your average online spend is about $2,000, but in-store it's an average $8,000. That's a big difference.
Yeah, there's a bit of causation correlation there that if you're buying a $500 Crown Metropole package, then you can probably buy it online. If you're buying a complex Europe itinerary of 15 different stops, you're much more likely to want to speak to someone. So stores do attract a certain type of, when I say a certain type of customer, a customer for a certain type of product. It'll be the same customer might buy online for Crown Casino, might buy offline for that Europe trip. So it can be the same person, but when I talk about different customer purchase at that time. So yeah, you're right. It does have a much, much higher basket. There is a bit of causation in that we can also work with our customers to create a better, fuller trip that maybe they would have just bought the hotel from us. Instead, we can sell them everything from the flight, the lounge, the transfers, the experiences, the multiple hotels, the cruises, all that kind of stuff that you might not buy if you're just buying online or even if you're just buying on the phone, because there's so much pressure on the phone to get the sale done. The customer just wants to get off the phone. Our call center is really busy. So it's a much more relaxed environment in store. And you sort of feel it when you go in there. There's no pressure. There's no rushing. Our team are happy to sit with you as long as you need. If you need to spend 2 hours booking that trip, that's fine. If you want to come in and out in 5 minutes, that's fine as well. So you don't get that mentality on a phone, and obviously online people are just booking themselves without the guidance and assistance of a consultant, which is completely fine for lots of different products, but certain products you probably do want or need that guidance, because most people, even myself included, don't know about everywhere in the world. If you're going to the Stands, if you're going to Montenegro, if you're going to South America, there's a lot of things we just don't know. So you're often just better at speaking to somebody who's an expert who's been there before. If you go into Maldives even, there's a lot of complexity in booking the right flights and booking the right resort for what you want. So there's actually a bit of complexity there. And unless someone's been there or at least has a really great understanding of the region and the destination, you're not going to get as good a trip as otherwise could have.
So before Chadstone and Bondi Junction, you did have a pop-up store. How important was that pop-up to, you know, making you take the leap into bricks and mortar?
We actually had two pop-ups and a pop-up in Chadstone. So two, certainly had two, and then the third Chadstone, we had a pop-up then permanent, but it was always going to be permanent. So really two pop-ups. And second pop-up wasn't particularly successful. The first one was quite successful. I think what we learned more not what not to do than what to do, but it definitely gave us, it certainly gave me confidence that there was a market there that we thought could be ripe for this. Obviously, when you're putting a couple of million bucks plus in a fit out and signing a lease that has a $5+ million obligation, you kind of want to have some degree of confidence going into the pop-up. Certainly gave us that confidence. We actually didn't think it would be anywhere as successful as it has been, certainly in terms of Chatty. By the time we got to Bondi, we'd had Chadstone, so we sort of had a pretty good idea. But certainly for Chatty, we didn't expect it to be as successful as it is. We thought, oh, I think we can cover our costs, maybe make a little bit of money and get that brand carry. But it turns out it's actually quite a profitable store and probably, I suspect, the highest grossing travel store globally. I don't think anybody would even come close to it, in fact. I think it's possibly upwards of double the next one. And this is global, not just within Australia. Obviously, we have very few stores, so that gives us an advantage over a Flight Centre who's got 300, 250 stores. So it's not really a fair comparison. Though their retail store network would turn over many multiples of what we do in the two. But in terms of specific stores, Chadstone will have to be up there with, if not number one, very close to, I suspect, pretty clear number one. And Bondi is probably not far off the top five even already. So they are really successful stores, do turn over a lot of revenue and, more importantly, provide this incredible experience for customers.
Yeah, I think I was reading that Chadstone was up 50% in the past 12 months.
Yeah, if not potentially more, actually. It just depends on sort of what we include in that calculation, because we also run our wholesale and a bit of our corporate business there as well, our corporate events business. And that really is helpful as well. So we're doing a heap of wholesale business every day. And if you want to organise a wedding, we can do that for you. If you want to organise a hen's night or a Bucks Day or a 50th birthday in Bali, we can do all that stuff for you and get sort of 30, 40, 50, 100 rooms booked. So, and with incredible inclusions and offers that obviously Luxuriescapes customers are used to. So we have a real competitive advantage in doing that stuff. So we'd love to do more. And the store is obviously a great way to start that.
So why Chadstone and Bondi Junction? What made that decision for you?
Yeah, it's Chatty's felt, certainly in hindsight, the obvious choice. Obviously, it's the biggest shopping centre in the Southern Hemisphere. It's clearly the number one shopping centre in Melbourne. It is demographically pretty much perfect for us. It's demographically in the centre of Melbourne. So a lot of factors in our favour. Ultimately, you obviously don't know how it's going to go, but we looked at Doncaster, looked at others as well, and we were really tempted by Doncaster. Obviously, slightly cheaper rent and a similar kind of clientele, but in the end, we just thought Chadstone was a better option. We'd rather go our best possible option than don't die wondering, rather than potentially going in at sort of A rather than A-plus centre. And also, given it was our first, obviously for Sydney, we were actually looking at Chatswood. And there's obviously they're basically completely renovated one centre and almost renovated the other one. Had we got a good site in Chatswood, we probably would have taken there, but the sites we're being offered just weren't amazing. And the site we got at Bondi was incredible. Next to Apple, across from Mecca, next to all kinds. You basically, on street frontage, plenty of light. You actually couldn't get a better spot anywhere in the centre, we think. So that was what guided us. And the Westfield, the Thames team were amazing to work with. In fact, both teams, Sydney and Centre, were both amazing to work with, but we got a lot of support from Centre and they were really great. So made the decision in the end pretty easy, and we had a great run with the setup and the opening, and it was a really great result.
And so you've talked about looking at other Australian cities. I hear you also have global domination in your sights.
Yeah, so in terms of a business, we do have about 15 to 18% of our sales come from people outside Australia. So we already have a non-Australian business. It is split really between mostly four or five different countries. So New Zealand obviously is a big market for us. UK's ahead of New Zealand now. It's number two, New Zealand number three. Then you've got US, Singapore, both really good markets. Then Germany and Canada are really nicely sort of improving markets. So certainly London and Singapore are the two that we'd like to at some point go into. We think there's probably three or four more Australian stores before we get there. But never, who knows what transpires in the next year or two, because I think our next door definitely is Australia. After that, who knows? Like certainly London, Manchester are really interesting markets for us. growing really quickly. The brand carry will be really helpful there. So it's pretty interesting, actually.
So shifting to technology, from in-store augmented reality to virtual try-ons, AR, VR technologies, it's all coming into the retail sector recently. How much of a role does technology play in your bricks and mortar strategy and by extension your online strategy?
Yeah, probably not crazy amounts. Obviously, the team in the store is fully equipped with everything you need to sell. We've got obviously massive screens for customers and all that. So we have used AR, VR in the past, but found it's probably limited benefit. Actually, funny enough, the sort of guidance of an experienced consultant is that we found is way more important than AR, VR. So yeah, we are obviously technology enabled, but it's really much more of a driver of our website and our app experience, probably a bit less those sort of stories, very much that classic offline experience. You're treated like a king, you walk in and you've got a travel expert who's probably been to Bali or Maldives or Thailand or wherever you're going to go, and they can give you this great expert advice that, but ultimately, people want to book online, they'll get access to our incredible suite of technology. But there is something really romantic about speaking to someone, speaking to a really smart person who understands travel, who understands what you want, who's going to ask questions and ask, try and really work out what's the perfect trip. And our team members are really consultants. They're there to build the best possible trip they can. And that's what will get people coming back. So we really do take a long-term customer view. We're not just trying to just sell something because we've got a high margin on it, like some of our sort of competitors in the travel space. We really do want to try and sell the best product. If you look at the way our website's ordered, it's ordered on margin per view. So it doesn't mean the person who's paying us the most, it means the product that's converting the best. So we really try and be guided by the customer, which is obviously a lot of people say everybody's customer-centric these days because of Jeff Bezos, but we really do try and impugn the customer in everything we do. And if it's online, we're using reams of data to create this incredible experience for you. And if it's offline, so you're not really changing the experience in that sense to personalise it, but you've obviously got a really smart consultant who will ask you questions and really guide you based on those answers.
And what about social media? How much are you leveraging social media and influencer marketing even to drive sales?
We've got an amazing team that does all that stuff. So Eugene, who heads it for us, is a former talent agent who runs our partnership, our influencer partnerships, heads up our social team as well. So Eugene is incredible at working with talent. There isn't a popular influencer in Australia that doesn't work with us, I suspect, in the travel space. And not just that, and this is obviously globally as well. So what makes that work is we've got well over 1 million Facebook, heading to 1 million Insta. It's that huge base of installed fans, essentially. And you combine that creating that great alchemy, combining those sort of couple million people with some amazing talent and knowing how to market it properly. And that's sort of the kind of three legs of the stool of influencer marketing. You can get the best influencer in the world. If you don't have a following, it's kind of pointless. You have the biggest following in the world. If you get the wrong influencers, it's pointless. So kind of got to get both right. And I think our team does an amazing job. So we'll push probably more direct than brand. So we'll often send influencers to resorts and hotels we're working with. So when we go live with the campaign, the influencer then starts their campaign and they might get all sorts of different sort of remuneration structures. But we want to work with the best talent who people trust to effectively create trust and credibility on the Luxury Escapes brand and hopefully move some packages as well. So yeah, that team does really well. It's a super growth part of the business. Not an easy part of the business, and you sort of just got to get quite a few things right. But our guys do a great job there, and we've got an amazing suite of partner influencers who continue to do an incredible job.
So you talked earlier on about pivots and how much you've had to pivot over time, and probably one of the biggest pivots of all, and it probably seems like a long time ago, was COVID. You know, how did you change tack at a time when, for many online travel agencies, it was a pretty disastrous time?
Yeah, it's a great question. Certainly the first few months weren't easy. Like, I don't think we can't rewrite history and say we cruised through it. It was till probably June, I think March, April, May were really tough, three really tough months. And by June, we were flying. And then it became sort of difficult because there was lockdowns. But yeah, we had a great month in June of 2020. Then we had a few tough months because of lockdowns and all that stuff. But like, we obviously suffered a short to medium-term EBITDA hit, so there's no question it hit our profitability, but it's really added to our long-term value. We were able to really lean in. Because we were online only at the time, we had no stores, we were able to really invest for the future, whereas all the other sort of travel businesses were having to do dilutive capital raises and couldn't come back quickly enough. So we had some really great tailwinds as well as headwinds, and we were able to take those tailwinds and really go hard for the couple of years post-COVID. And we're only probably starting the last call it 18 to 24 months, toning down on the hiring and all that sort of stuff. But we spent a couple of years being really aggressive and trying to get market share and trying to, more importantly, trying to build an incredible product that our customers love.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see people, I guess, rediscover their own backyard.
Yeah, we did a lot of domestic Australia sales during that COVID period. So we were lucky enough that we really had a pretty strong domestic Australia business. That's Australia to Australia. And a pretty strong US outbound business. US wasn't hit anything like Australia was hit. They were able to travel pretty much the whole time. So we were pretty lucky in that respect. So you sort of win some, you lose some. Obviously, our profitability was tough. But from a strategic perspective, it was really helpful in the long run.
So staying on COVID, but moving off the retail topic for a moment to something I think our property audience would be interested in, and that's some of your views on working from home. You've got offices in Australia, Britain, Spain and the US, and I've heard you say that the shift to working from home you believed was a failure on every front. Is that still the view?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when I first said that in probably 2021, there weren't many people who agreed. Maybe a few of your listeners agreed given they own commercial property, but I think most people weren't agreeing with this view. And I think it's become very mainstream. I think now it's like 90% of people probably agree with it. And the people who don't are self-interested because they want to work from home or whatever, which is fine. Everybody's entitled to their own preferences. But our view is for the team members, forgetting us, but for team members, it's infinitely better being in the office. And if you're 25 and trying to learn, you can't learn in front of a computer screen when your boss is in a different place. So it's just it creates a different vibe. There's no collaboration. You don't see half the people you're working with otherwise. So what I think is the worst is sort of that sort of 2 or 3 days. I think you've either got to take the view that everybody's in the office, or if you want to be a fully remote team, whatever, be that. There's not many businesses can make that work, but some can. But I think that sort of 2 or 3 day hybrid is just messy when half the people are in, half people aren't. You don't know if people are going to be in. They've got seating issues. It's just for the sake of saving a few dollars on rent, which is usually a pretty small part of your OPEX, it just, to me, it makes no sense to destroy the employee experience. And I think there's a bit of a carrot and stick. We do daily lunches in both our offices, going to start trialling daily dinners in Sydney, looking at getting a hairdresser in. Like we think there's, you've got to invest in the office as well. You can't just sort of having 70-style cubicles and hope people come back in. We think and our offices are pretty beautiful, are both beautiful environments. We invested, again, a lot in the fit out of the offices. Like same people who did our stores did the offices. So we got incredible level of fit out that really feels a bit like old school WeWork design-wise, forget business model-wise, design-wise. So we want to make sure the office is a beautiful place to come to. And if you look, again, Scott Galloway says the thing that keeps people in their jobs more than anything is having one friend at work. Really hard to have a friend at work if you're working by yourself at home. So that's a really big focus for us. Part of the focus of lunches is to cross-collaborate and meet people you otherwise wouldn't have met because you're sitting next to them at the lunch table. And whether you're the CEO, whether you're your first day in the office, you're sort of everybody's equal in the lunch line. So we've been more convinced in our view. We see our turnovers drop to basically pre-COVID level. In fact, that turnover is almost too low now. So we'd rather, you almost want to have a degree of turnover and you can have the point where you have too little. So that's a different sort of problem, but certainly a much better problem than the reverse, which is two people leaving. And when we do the numbers, we saw you had a 50% higher likelihood of leaving the business if you work remotely. And we think that's just because you've got no connection to your colleagues and to the business. So the data's been really clear. Our team's been really clear. I'm sure there's no doubt there's a person or two here that doesn't want to come in, but I think virtually everybody, when we interview somebody, we tell them this is we're in an office environment. If that's not for you, maybe there's other places that might be better for you to work. So we really upfront and honest about it, because it's been really a 4-year cycle since we've been back in some degree to the office. Almost everybody's either wants to work, so legacy team members and want to work in the office anyway, or they're sort of from day zero know that this is how it is, so probably want to work in this environment. So you kind of build the environment and build the team that you want. If you want to work from home, there's plenty of places that can offer that. If businesses want to do that, I'm not going to tell anybody else how to run that. I'm always surprised by the vitriol directed at me or us when somebody sees, if somebody that wants to work from home, they can work from home. It's not my business. I'm just, the anger that gets directed, and clearly it's people are worried that some sort of gravy train or rot's going to get sort of used up by everyone, and that if people see what we do and that it's working, that they're easy sort of 6 hours a day at home, no commuting, might get disrupted and they don't like it. But that's sort of not how we want to operate. We want to pay the best for the best people who want to be in person, and that's sort of how we want to operate. And really, that's a customer-centric mentality. We want our customers to be served really well. We've got people in stores who can't be working from home. We've got people on the road who can't be working from home. We just think it's a much fairer way to do it.
Yeah, that level of vitriol, I completely get what you're saying. Whenever we put out a research report which talks about office occupancy rates and it might get covered in a newspaper, And the comments on the stories, it's like, I think we got compared to being the devil in one comic for talking about office occupancy and return to office. So that vitriol is really interesting.
I think it's a pretty small subset of people who are just really vocal. There's other topics that you get a similar sort of vocal minority on. I think we've seen in the last few years the rise of the silent majority, and it still is a very vocal minority, and they'll push their own agenda. And I said, I have no issue with people wanting to work from home, not for us, but if you want to work from home for our competitor, that's fantastic because it means we'll have a competitor advantage and it'll make our business even stronger. And we've had, since the last, certainly the last 3 or 4 years since we've been 5 days a week, we've had the best performance the business has had in its history. So if there's, and it's hard to sort of correlate these two things necessarily, but certainly if you're trying to find a pattern, we've performed better than ever being back in the office. Our team's better than ever. We've got an incredible team both in Sydney and Melbourne and Gold Coast and London and we're in Barcelona, and that's with an in-office environment. Our tech team is literally the best in the country. We're getting people out of Atlassian, who's famous for that work everywhere policy. We'll find it turns out people actually don't want to work from everywhere. People want to work with other people. Not everybody, but a lot of people do. And we want to get the best people. And these, it feels like the kind of people who do want to work collaboratively. So our team is so good now. And you hear people saying, oh, you won't get good people unless you let them work from home. Well, our experience has been the complete opposite.
So on a personal note, you're no stranger to podcasts yourself. In fact, you co-host your own, The Contrarians. How do you squeeze so much into your day, balancing business, family, and personal interests?
I think we're just pretty efficient with how we, both Adira and I, how we use our time. So we, our pod, we don't spend hours and hours planning. I do a bit of planning. Adira kind of rocks up. We've got a pretty good level of background knowledge. Adira especially just knows a lot about a lot of business stuff. So he can take his sort of years of learned wisdom and bring it. And we've got an incredible listener base, a really, like yourself, a really sophisticated listener base that likes to be treated seriously. And I'm not sure there are that many business podcasts in Australia that really respect their audience like we do. So yeah, it's great fun. In terms of sort of day-to-day, I just try and be as efficient as possible. I got couple of youngish kids, and fortunately got a wife who's incredible at doing all that stuff with them as well. So I'm not super helpful all the time, but try to do as much as I can. But yeah, I think we've also got an amazing team here. So it's different to when you're a startup with 5 people and you're doing every role. Now I've got 630 people and just a phenomenal team that means I don't have to be on the tools all day, every day. I'll be doing as much as I can and helping where I can, but I'm much less required these days than I used to be.
So a couple of quick questions to close us out. Given you do work for a travel company, or I should say own a travel company, what's your favourite holiday destination when you do get some downtime?
I'm a skier, so I love going skiing, but taking that aside, probably Maldives in terms of sort of tropical destinations. It's one of the few places on earth that's actually better in real life than in the photos. People think, oh, it can't be that good. Well, it's actually better. The food's amazing. The weather's amazing. The snorkeling and diving's amazing. The people are fantastic. It's everything about it's incredible. The caliber of accommodation's next level. So I love Maldives. We also happen to have a direct Melbourne to Malé flight, only one in Australia, so that's a little bit biased. But even without that, it is an amazing destination. And value for money wise, yeah, it's not a cheap destination. You're up for sort of $1,000 a night, generally minimal. Then you get some cheaper places, but $1,000 a night. But what you get for that $1,000 a night, like you pay $1,000 a night in Australia and you don't get that much. You pay $1,000 a night in Maldives, you're getting all-inclusive French champagne, incredible Michelin star caliber dining. It is pretty amazing. So value for money wise, it's one of the best I've experienced.
And what do you think is one of the keys to business success?
Oh, I don't know. I think being lucky is probably really important. I think yes. We've been in the right place at the right time so many times. Like I talked about all those pivots, like Jez and I just have ridden this wave of luck from going to the right school, from meeting each other, from being lucky enough to go to uni and get a law degree and all that stuff and have a great family who's super supportive. So I think we've had just a great run. I think often the difference between success and failure is just being in the right place at the right time and having a lot of luck along the way. Yeah, we worked reasonably hard in the early days, but so did lots of people. I'm not sure that's sort of definitive. We just kind of fell into it, and we fell into that first business, second one, third one, and even the way we got to Luxury Escapes, that was super lucky as well. We'd never stayed in a 5-star hotel before we started this business called Luxury Escapes. So we're a sort of story filled with serendipity. So I'm not sure there's anything we did specifically that's particularly inspirational, just being sort of making the most of our chances when they came, but that's just sort of right place, right time.
Yeah, serendipity, I love it. And one last question, what's next for Luxury Escapes? What can we expect?
I think we're going to keep getting better. Like, so we've done a lot of different stuff in the last probably 6 years since COVID. So we've sort of built a marketplace for accommodation, built more tours, built our cruise platform, built a loyalty platform, built a subscription platform, all and a heap of back-end stuff just to make the experience a lot better. So we're constantly building. We've got an incredible development team I've talked about before, and we've got an amazing product manager team. We're just trying to work out how do we create – we think we've got the best travel buying experience in the world. We just want to keep getting better though. We've got the best – one of the best loyalty programs in the world. We're going to keep making it better. We don't want to be a day two business. We want to constantly be a day one business like Jeff Bezos says, and how can we keep making the customer experience better every day?
Well, thank you so much for joining Talking Property. I'm feeling very inspired now to book my next holiday, probably to the Maldives, and I might just have to do it in store.
Thanks, Kath. Great to chat.
To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Property. I'll also include a link in the show notes to CBRE's recent Regional Shopping Centres Reimagined report, which shows how landlords are amping up the customer experience to ensure shoppers stay longer and spend more. If you don't already subscribe to Talking Property, make sure you do so wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love for you to rate or review the show, which will help other people find us. Until next time.